Radio, and here we go, another episode of the We Talk Music Podcast on the air and in your ear. And I am Martin, and I am joined by, well, nobody this time. I'm afraid my co-host, my regular co-host Brett, is not here, but that's okay. We don't need him. After all, I have a fantastic guest who's joining me, Brian Ray. You've worked with your band, The Bayonets, your solo stuff, of course, Etta James, and probably most famously, Paul McCartney. Thank you very much for joining us.
It's my great pleasure. Thanks so much, Martin. How are you today?
You know, I am great. I'm really looking forward to talking to you. I really want to talk about this new single of yours. I've got a new thing. It's got a very powerful message behind it.
Yes, it does. Thank you so much for your interest in it. I'm super excited and proud of this one. It just came out, and you may have heard that Little Steven of Bruce Springsteen's E Street Band and Sopranos and Lilyhammer fame just deemed it the coolest song in the world on his renowned radio outlet on Sirius XM, the Underground Garage.
And this isn't the first time you've had that particular honor either. So it might just be the coolest song. Tell us a little bit about the story behind the song. It's, as I say, it's a very powerful message you're getting across.
Well, thanks so much. Yeah. You know, I guess there's that old quote that says great songs aren't written, they're rewritten. And if this is indeed a great song, I'm fond of it, but that would be for someone else to judge. You know, it started out as a goodbye breakup song. Right. And the first title was Sayonara Baby. But I ended up changing the lyric as we went along here and decided I wanted to make it more than a breakup song. I mean, we've heard a billion breakup songs. So I decided to make it about the empowerment of a victim of sexual abuse or of coercion at the hands of a cult leader. Finally meeting, having justice meted out. And so this is a song for victims and survivors of abuse and of coercion.
What's interesting to me about that message and that song is so often with victims of any sort of assault, it's easier for them to forgive the person that has assaulted them than it is necessarily to forgive themselves. So, I mean, you're kind of turning that on its head a little bit. And I like that.
Yeah. That's a really great point. I mean, any survivor of, say, coercion from some weird cult, like, you know, Keith Raniere and Nexium and DOS and all those weird things, who had stationed up in Canada for some time in Vancouver, mm-hmm. by the way, but, these victims have to go through a very harrowing ordeal facing that, yes, they were indeed abused, and then they have to face it and digest that information, then turn around and forgive themselves for being duped. And I can't even imagine what that's like, but anyway, this is a song for those victims, those survivors turning around and watching their abuser being walked away in handcuffs.
Do you consider yourself a storyteller first and foremost, who uses music to tell the stories?
Well, not really. I guess that when I take on a new song, a new lyric, I feel there's a responsibility in there to bring the listener through whatever this story or this journey is of the lyric. And you do, you know, certain things to accomplish that. And one of the things that I like to do when you're talking, like, you know, trying to bring a listener in and keep their attention, is you want the song, the lyric to grow. You want them to hear the first line and go, oh, really? Tell me more. Oh, really? Wait, is there more? You know, you want to continue bringing in their curiosity, and you want them engaged. And look, at in a pop song you have 3 minutes and 30 seconds or so to do that, so you want to grab them quick. It's like a very short movie for your mind, for your ears.
That's true. That's true. I mean, you have to get it across quickly and connect to the audience. And then the question is quite obvious. Your songwriting process, is there one process that you follow where it's like you get the music first, or you get the lyric first, or the song title, or is it kind of all over the place?
It's kind of all over the place, but it's a great question, Martin. Thanks. I mean, you know, in the case of this song, Got a New Thing, it started with the lick. It started there, and then that led to, you know, that already had the rhythm implied. So I had a tempo. It's kind of a bright rock and roll tempo. And then the verse chords that no longer feature that lick, that riff I just sang, those chords are implied in the riff. So those chords are never playing during the riff, but they are the chords that go to the riff. So, you know, it's a two for one. You know, I got the intro of the vocals, then the riff, and then the chords to the first verse are just pulled from the riff. So then it's just about writing the chorus chords. In this case, I rewrote the chorus. And when I did, it was a big sort of breakthrough moment. It was very simple. It was just three chords. And who needs more in a rock song? And, and a different melody and a very simple lyric, you know, a celebration. And I thought, well, really, can I say got a new thing after, you know, the sort of, you know, repressed anger that the victim is talking about here? Can I express joy and move on? And I thought that's exactly what I want to do. And so it all just kind of came together when I got that very simple chorus going.
It sounds like an interesting combination with you of intellectually studying the song and seeing what it needs, and yet also allowing it to flow naturally and feel from you.
Well, that's interesting. I look at it as all instinctual. You know, it none of it is intellectual, really, until you get down to exact word choices and things like that. There's no, I hate to say it, there's very little intellect going on.
That's why you're a perfect guest on this show.
Anyway, what's that?
That's why you're a perfect guest on this show.
Well, anyway, you and I, bereft of intellect, will forage forward. You know, for me, it's instinctual. I liked my original chorus that led to So Long, Sayonara, but it was very wordy. And to me, I wanted something that was just a little bit more broad brush, more sing-song, not so demanding of, you know, of your attention. When I wrote the verse lyrics, it was kind of what they call a building lyric. That means you start a line, then you add a couple words, then you add some more words. And while you're doing that, the meaning starts to change. So you've got the listener with the first line, and then you bring them in a little further, and then you twist it, you know, and that's sort of what I wanted to do. So when you do all that kind of mental manipulation of the listener, you want to just give them a really nice, simple payoff in the chorus. And that's what I think I accomplished that.
Yeah, I think you absolutely accomplished that. And it's a really cool tone. It really is. I mean, it's, you know, and I'm fascinated with the, you know, this process of the song making, but the, do you play the guitar? Are you like messing around with the guitar every day and then you come up with that lyric that lick? Or do you sit there and you go, okay, I'm going to write a song. I'm going to just keep going at it. Like what is it that kind of, how do you discover it? Many of us like myself will never know the feeling of coming up with a great lick. And I can just imagine what that feels like when you go, oh, I got something.
That's really interesting. To be honest with you, this is more evidence of very little intellect. I don't think about it, and I don't work at it, to be honest with you. I'm sorry to say, but happy to report that I'll sit down and start something, and it either clicks for me or it doesn't. And if it doesn't, then I just start playing something else. And either that clicks for me or it becomes a practice session. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it's only when I sit down and I have kind of just an instinct in my mind, and that has maybe a tempo and a cadence, and I hear something in my mind, then I go and play it. And if you want to get really nerdy and particular about this, because that's kind of what we're doing.
Yeah.
In this case, can I tell you a little bit about this lick? Okay, so it's no big deal. It's a simple lick, but it's a little bit of a riddle lick. It's not the simplest riff in the world, but a kid could play it, right? So I thought most riff rock songs, and this is not, you know, this is not the first time those first four notes have been heard together. I mean, those first four notes are, like, I hate to tell you, but they're in about 100 rock songs. But it's what you do after that. And so for me, I went do 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 do. Now at that point, I could choose to just repeat that or add to it a building riff and make it twice as long a riff. In other words, in musical parlance, you would say it's a 2-bar phrase or a 4-bar phrase, right? Counting to four twice is a 2-bar riff. Counting to four times would be a 4-bar riff. So I decided I wanted to build on it and see how that felt. The first time I did it, it was like, oh no, that's too many notes. That's stupid. And then I kept coming back to it, and I decided this is a 4-bar phrase. And that's a little bit unusual in riff rock, to be honest with you. Most riff rock songs, if you study them, they're 2-bar phrases. And that's cool. You know, I love that, but I think we could demand just a little bit more of the listener, you know? And so, I'm sorry, really long explanation.
No, I love boring, it.
I just want to let you in on the process.
Yeah. No, that's extremely cool. That's thank you very much for going into that.
Sure.
My favorite song, I think, actually in your catalog might be Spellbreaker. I love that. That's
wow.
A great, great bluesy song. Michael DeBars is a former guest on the show, just a ball of energy. tell me a little bit about that one. Pardon me?
Well, he's a maniac. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've known Michael for a very long time, and we'd worked together on several projects, including a cover band back in, 2001 or something like that, right around the 9/11, we were working together as a band with Scott Schreiner on bass from Weezer, who appears on my new single and many of my other songs. Anyway, shoot forward many years. Now he lands a gig at the radio station where I've been getting a lot of play, like a lot. You know, now he's a DJ there. He's a very successful DJ at Little Steven's Underground Garage, Sirius XM 21. And I was looking for, we're in touch. We're talking fairly often. And I said, I'd love to produce a song for you, just a single. I don't want to do a whole album. I'm busy doing other stuff, but I really would love to do that. And he goes, okay, cool. And we wrote a song, and the song was called Rule Breaker. And it was going to be a single for him. Well, the tempo of Spellbreaker and the feel of it, a 6/8 sort of kind of like a blues ballad, isn't what the Underground Garage plays, unfortunately. So they said, you know, it's very cool, but it's not a single for the Underground Garage. I went, ah. So we just left it, told Michael the news that they had turned it down, went on, and then it came time for me to do another single. I thought, there's a song in theirs. There's still, what if it's a B-side? And what if I'm the artist, because I need a B-side, and what if Michael and I then rewrite the lyric completely? And I came up with this new idea, which is Spellbreaker. And it was a really fun lyric to write. He and I wrote it pretty much, I think, over the phone. And I came up with the lion's share of the lyric, and then he came up with some really great ideas to lend to it. Then I sang the lead vocal, and he came over and sang some harmonies and some howls and cackles and stuff. And And there you go. We had a record, and I used some of the original guitar work that I had done on our previous version called Rule Breaker.
Yeah, I would love to actually hear that back to back now, to hear the difference between the two versions, because like I say, I love Spellbreaker. I think it's just a great song.
Well, thank you so much. You know, can I just briefly talk about that? That one to me was also another fun lyric exercise. Once I came up with the idea Spellbreaker, okay, well, what is that? You know, then, you know, you could be the guy is trying to seduce and cajole a woman that he's fond of into telling her that he's even cooler than the guys she used to idolize. You know, the Steve McQueen, the Marlon Brandos, the Rudolph Valentinos of the world. And so he tells her that he's the one who's even more powerful than them. And that's Spellbreaker.
Yeah, that was really cool. Thank you. I love getting into the kind of the minutia of the songs, obviously. What about the songwriting then? How did you do it with the Bayonets? Was that kind of a similar process for you? Or, I mean, now you're working, you know, with somebody and kind of what's the songwriting process there?
Yeah, Bayonets, such a fun, satisfying project. I mean, Martin, we worked one album. It didn't even start off as an album. It started off as, let's do a series of singles just for fun. And then little Steven discovers us because his wife played him our first single, which was going to be released, and I guess it was 2012 or 13 on Valentine's Day, and it was called Sucker for Love, and we had a cool video for it. Well, Maureen Van Zandt, lovely Maureen Van Zandt, plays it for Steven after discovering it on Twitter on Valentine's Day, the day of the release, and she sent me a tweet or something saying, can I give Steven your email? What's your email? Steven wants to reach out to you. I get an email from Steven the next day saying, who is this? What is this? Can I have some more? I love this song. I'm going to play the heck out of it. Do you mind if I do an edit? If you do mind, that's okay too. You can keep the edit. You can give me credit. You can not give me credit. I love this. And I was like, whoa. And, you know, it was one of those moments, one of those messages that kind of you feel like your world has shifted a little bit. I mean, my world shifted a lot when I started playing with Paul McCartney and then previously with Etta James, but this was like a new level because it was songwriting, you know, that was getting attention. Anyway, so the Bayonets came along, just to back it up a little bit, because I had done two solo albums. My first one, Mondo Magneto, and my second one, This Way Up, on which Oliver Lieber, my Bayonet songwriting and band partner, co-wrote many of the songs on both of those albums and helped me with tones and ideas. And he was really, really helpful and really plugged in. When it came time for me to start thinking I wanted to do a third solo album, you know, both of my first two solo albums are kind of cult acknowledged, but you know, they're not like giant sellers. I wasn't getting a ton of airplay, but anyway, I was sure enjoying the process. Well, I came to Oliver and said, let's start writing some more. And he goes, that's cool. I'd rather do a band. You want to do a band? And I go, sure. Okay. And all in one meeting, we decided we were going to do a band. We talked about what that band would sound like, why it would be different than Brian Ray, and what the elements would be. And we went forward with looking for a name, which resulted in the Bayonets. And our songwriting process had all just grew. So with my solo albums, a lot of the time I would come to Oliver just for a lyric assistance. I'd have the song already recorded and I'd come to him and go, here's the song, here's the title. I need some more help with these verses, or I need a new chorus, or let's write a lyric. And we'd do a bunch of it over the phone. and it's very satisfying and very fun and very easy. We have a great writing relationship, and I think we both enjoy that a lot. Anyway, the Bayonets is a little different. Now we started writing in person, and we started with, as I said, five songs, and we got that traction at Little Steven's Underground Garage, so that gave us a big boost, and we thought, let's do some more. And then we landed an album deal with Jem Records, J-E-M, and they packaged the album plus two more songs. And now we have 12 songs together, you know, back then. And then we did a Christmas song on top of that, a standalone single, Christmas Time is Cruel.
Yes, and that is quite the Christmas song.
Sort of like, what's that?
I said that's quite the Christmas song.
Yeah, it's a really Debbie Downer. But I love that song. It's really dear to me. And to me, you know, the holidays do come with a mixed bag of emotions. And I thought we needed to give rise to some of the bluesier feelings that come up for Christmas for some of us.
Yeah,
anyway,
and they definitely will come up for people in 2020.
Oof, no kidding.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully New Year's will be a far better New Year's.
Yes.
But anyway, yeah, that's our writing process. We enjoy writing together, and we've written so many songs over the years, and we have a great energy together in songwriting.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned the music video for Sucker for Love, but the one I love is the Crash Boom Bang. Sorry. That video, I love that because it's so, it's well cast, obviously, but you just look like you're having so much fun.
It's so silly. Yeah, I haven't seen that in a long time, but we found this place, this theater in the valley here in Southern California, a wide expanse, if you don't know, residential and business area. That is a valley we call the Valley. Well, that includes a lot of small towns and villages, but anyway, the Valley. And there's a theater out there, and it's only maybe, I don't know, 200 seat theater or something like that, but it's a magician's theater. And it's very, very cool. It's got old music posters all around, old magician posters all around, and it's got an inventory of magic tricks, big physical, you know, secret boxes and the sawn in half boxes and gauges and crazy things all backstage. And we rented it out and we could use some of those things. So we decided we would, involve all of that and use a projection screen. And it was a really fun day.
No, it comes across in the video, you know, that you're having a good time. And I think that's what makes it work so much. When you were, I guess it was Vagabond Soul, and you had Steven Tyler on that, how did you get him to do the harmonica instead of you doing it yourself? Did you just kind of go, hey, you take a shot at this? Or did he say to you, you know, I want to do this? Or how did that come about?
Well, basically, I'm no good at harmonica. I've played harmonica maybe twice in my life. And, the second time I played, it was on Crash Boom Bang, the solo there.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just like, you know, I practiced just a little bit and then recorded it. It was a first take. And then I did it again to double it so that it sounded a little better. It was a cheap harmonica. It didn't even sound good, but I thought it's a garage rock song. Who cares? Anyway, that's my wild career as a harmonica player. When it came time to do Vagabond Soul for the Bayonets, you know, I have a friendship with Steven Tyler, who I call my madre from another, my compadre from another madre. And he's my buddy. And I called him up and just thought, you know, what's the worst he could do? Like, are you kidding me? I'm too busy for you. That could have been the worst. But he texted right back and said, I'm in. We're going to go deep. Let's do this. And I was like, oh man, this is so cool. So we drove over with his then assistant and now girlfriend. I don't know if they're married, Amy. And they came over and he spent a good 3 or 4 hours with us. played him the song again. I had sent him the track, played him the song. He got familiar with it. Showed him a couple of my melody ideas for backgrounds, and then asked if he wanted to play some harmonica. And he pulls out a briefcase with about 30 harmonicas in it and started fiddling around with those. And before you know it, he's like saying, let me do that again. Okay, let me punch me in there. Okay, I got another idea for another harmony. Okay, what if I do this? And it was just like, you know, he was so generous and he came in with so much energy. It was just like the loveliest day. So, so cool.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. That's a great story. I love the idea of him having 30 harmonicas or whatever in a briefcase. It's one of those instruments that I think people don't recognize just how difficult it is. And my father's been attempting to master it for years and is still, you know, at his own admission, still just at the beginner level. Like, it's, you know, he shows me the experts on YouTube where he wants to get to. And I think, man, those guys are amazing.
Yeah, Toots Thielman, for one. Amazing. There's some amazing guys out there for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. So we are, unfortunately, I'm noticing now we've already gone past our time. I just want to check your availability here. If we go a few more minutes, are you okay?
Yeah, let me just look at the time because I do have another one. Yeah, I have a little bit more time.
Okay.
Let me see. Let me look real quick. Hang on. Yeah, I can continue going. I can give you another 10 minutes. How's that?
That would be fantastic because I am really enjoying myself here. So I hope you are as well. You know,
yeah, I sure am, man. I'm not talking too much.
No, you know, that's, people aren't here to listen to me. People are here for you, you know, and I love this stuff. I mean, it seems to me like you're a person who can absolutely write a book. You have so many stories and so many people you've played with, and you must have, you know, so much. You mentioned Etta James earlier, and I could never have played with Etta James because every time she sang At Last, I would have stopped playing and just stared at her. I would have just been lost in the moment.
Start crying, yeah. I mean, wow. What a tutelage, you know. It was just the best apprenticeship ever, leading to Paul McCartney, the best apprenticeship ever. I just don't know how I got so lucky, but yeah, Etta James, if not for her, I wouldn't have been the right guy for Paul McCartney. She trained me from a very young age. I was 18 when I met her, you know, and we went on to work together for 30 years, 15 of those years as her musical director and guitar player. But then years and years after that with various other projects, including, you know, her singing on Soft Machine from my first album.
Mm-hmm. Would the fact that you were actually 18, was that kind of a blessing? Because, I mean, the whirlwind of being, you know, with her as her career begins a resurgence, you know, you're too young to know any better. You're just out there playing. Is that kind of a blessing?
Yeah, I think about that. And I think, my God, how could she take such a gamble on me? I was just a little skinny, long-haired white kid with a lot of desire, and maybe I'd listen to the right guitar players that were in her wheelhouse when I was learning how to play guitar, so she recognized something. But basically, I was an unproven kid. How could she take such a chance? And then I think about it and I go, well, maybe she did that because she was rebuilding a career after a long battle with heroin addiction. Mm-hmm. And to her, she had blown it with her band, even with promoters, with everybody, managers, record labels. And maybe she thought she needed somebody young who would really be dedicated to her and just devoted to her and wouldn't ask questions and wouldn't be another demanding person, you know, just someone she could count on. And for some reason, I was lucky enough to be that guy, you know.
And I know she appreciated that and appreciated you that, you know, she, what was the quote? She said something when she was going to be on your album, I'd do anything for Brian. Wasn't that something like that?
Yeah, that's right. She told that to her son, Donto, who I, you know, who was basically 3 years old when I met her, you know, and he would be in the back seat with me when we would drive up to Santa Barbara to play a gig, you know, just this little kid. Well, later, of course, he grew up and was her drummer for many years. But anyway, when I asked Donto, who was already playing drums for her in 2004 or so, I said, do you think your mom would be willing to sing a little guest vocal with me? And he said, I'll ask. And he came back and gave me that quote. He said, Brian, sure, of course. Are you kidding? I'd do anything for Brian. And gosh, made me feel great. You know, obviously.
So cool. I got goosebumps just listening to that story, you know? And that's for me, so I can imagine what it feels like for you.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I look at it and I just go like, did that even happen? It's just so crazy.
Yeah.
And then to end up with the great, you know, Paul McCartney. I don't know. It's just an insane sort of convergence of luck and fortune.
Do you recall what you were thinking moments before taking the stage at the Super Bowl?
Oh my God. I wasn't thinking. I was just, you know, I was running on fumes. I must have looked like, you know, a feral cat. I don't know what I was doing. I was sort of, you know, outside my own body, kind of numb. And, you know, it goes back to what I was just saying. I had done some scary and wonderful things with Etta James that prepared me for a moment and many other bands and tours. Many exciting and scary things with Etta James, you know, opening for the Stones at age 23, you know, things that scared me a lot and were very adrenalizing kind of events, you know, so that when it was time to go on stage in advance of the Super Bowl 2002 with Paul McCartney for my quote unquote audition, you know, I think that the years with Etta James sort of tempered me, like, you know, like a blade over fire, you know.
I can only imagine what is the most surreal experience of your career, if it's that or there's something else, playing with Etta James, you know, their first show with her perhaps, or playing with Bobby Pickett, doing Monster Mash dressed as a zombie, as I know you were. I can only imagine what is the most surreal experience in your life. It could, you know, probably impossible to quantify which one is the most surreal.
Yeah, it's just, yeah, it's a lot. I don't really slow down to put it all together and think about it in a linear way or anything like that, because I'm busy doing what I'm doing today, you know, talking to you about a new single that I recorded on my own, you know, with some friends, you know, Abe Laboriel Jr. from Paul's band and Scott Schreiner from Weezer. You know, that's what I'm excited about today. And a video that's going to come out Monday, you know, it's like, I don't know. I just keep going forward, you know, and maybe I will put it all together later and look at it, you know, but the time now is just to continue with the writing and the work.
Well, we absolutely, you know, I can't wait to see the music video. Do you know what the next project is after this video, or the next song or single? Have you got that kind of picked out yet?
I have no idea. Nope.
No?
Nope.
No,
I have no idea.
You have no idea. What, and when the music video is, comes out shortly, what can we expect? Where did you shoot this video, especially in the days of, you know, a pandemic? Where was this video shot?
Yeah, well, you know, I have this really cool friend who is in the Netherlands, named Fritz, and he does commercial digital content and things like that over there. And he is kind of a friend and fan on social media for a long time. And I think he just offered to do something for me on my previous video, or my previous single called I Ain't Superstitious. That was the A side of your Spellbreaker.
Mm-hmm.
He did such a fantastic job of a sort of cool graphics and a kind of a movie lyric video for I Ain't Superstitious. when this next one came up, that went so well, and he had a good time doing it, and I did too. I asked him if he'd be willing to do another one, and he said, would you be open to some ideas? And I said, yeah. He says, remember those cool iPod commercials from the 2000s where you'd have like a silhouette person dancing and then a bright colored background, and you'd see the cable of the earbuds. And I said, yeah. He says, well, why don't we start there and do a takeoff on that? And I said, oh, that sounds great.
That's cool.
So, yeah, quickly, and then I'm going to have to jump because I've got another one coming up here. What happened was we had over here at my house, I shot a video on my iPhone and set it to like 4K and put it on a stool leaning against a book, cleared away an area against a wall, and brought out my guitar and just did one take of me kind of singing it and grooving out here. And then I asked Scott Schreiner from Weezer and Abe Laboriel if they would do the same. And then they did on their iPhones at their houses. And I never looked at their footage, their raw footage. I just set them up with Fritz. They sent it to him. And then Fritz put it together, digitized it, did some AI work so that it appears as if we are together. But the fun thing about it is that rather than us just being together, he can change the perspective and the scale and the relation, the sort of visual relationship of our images digitally. So in one shot, I'm way back tiny and Abe's forward and nude, or the opposite, so it's really fun and playful.
Well, I know you have to jump off. This time just flew by. I had just so much fun talking to you, Brian. I don't want to leave without giving you a chance to tell everybody where they can keep up with you. Please plug your stuff.
Okay, sure. Well, thanks so much, Martin. I've sure enjoyed this too. What a great chat. And thank you for, paying attention to all these things. It's always surprising when somebody knows about something you did 25 years ago or 45 years ago. Thank you so much. So on social media, most places I'm at Brian Ray Guitar. And then at Facebook, it's just my name. And my website is brianray.com. You can pre-order the singles, and they're all on vinyl. Most all, except for the very first one with Wicked Cool. So yeah, you can find my singles either signed or unsigned, plus some other goodies over at my website, or you can go to Wicked Cool's Bandcamp site if you want it, just from their site as well. That's good too. And you can find the music at all of your favorite digital music shops.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. And is it true you have a pool shaped like a Les Paul called Les Pool?
It's true.
That's awesome. Thank you, sir. I hope you have a great remainder of the day.
Thanks so much, Martin. Have a great day. Great to chat with you.
Thank you. I hope to do it again.
Okay, bye-bye.